I'm interested in the way that the personal and the political are intertwined in your work. And there's a part of me that thinks of that in relationship to your earlier practice with regard to advocacy and activism as part of a NGO, as part of a non-governmental organization. So I guess I'm interested in the relationship between the personal and political, but also the relationship between that earlier period of your practice and the contemporary period that you now inhabit, where you identify as an artist.
Actually, many people ask me this question, why the shift from being an NGO worker into being an artist. I would just say it's kind of a natural progression, because I think the reason why I become an NGO worker, I think is about finding a way or a position in the society where I can make a positive impact to the world, and while being happy and content myself and utilizing the capabilities that I have. So when I studied sociology in the university, and afterwards when I graduated, I think wow, NGO work. And at that time I was working for poverty alleviation projects in rural China. I thought that's really something I really like to do, and it would make a really positive impact to the world. Whether that is political or not, I don't really know whether I can define that as necessarily all political, because I think what I want is that I would make a positive impact to the world while myself also being happy and content. So that there's a personal part of it that, through this work that I'm doing, I would be happy, and in a way I'll be learning and improving myself and the world. So
for you, there's a relationship between the arts and advocacy, in a way, that it's not one or the other. And in a certain sense, you would almost argue that your work today is even more political insofar as it's more concerned with an impact, let's say.
I won't really say my work, as political. As more and more I explain what I try to do with my work, mm-hmm. a lot of my work, draws inspiration from political situation, from social situations. But what I try to do with my work, of course, is to draw attention to these political issues or incoherencies. But what I want is actually to speak about bigger things rather than just political situation, because I think the problems in politics or problems in the political system actually came from something bigger about people's thinking, about the human condition. And I think, if I just say that is just, if I only term that as political, it would actually limit the what I want to do with my work, because precisely I want to open up, the different possibilities of looking at these situations. Although some of these work, I might take the inspiration or even directly some terms and slogans from political situation, but what I really want people to think or reflect is not just the political system, is to step back and think why these situations happened. Maybe it's not just about the system, it's also about people's thinking. And, it's social, it's philosophical, it has many, many aspects.
So I'm interested then, for instance, in your work, Please Ask Me Why, from 2010, mm-hmm. where you mm-hmm. Wrote on the ceiling of a large gallery in Beijing, no thinking. I'm also interested in your work, like your Red Capital Land from 2010 as well, where mm-hmm. it almost looks like you're in Tiananmen Square, where you now see lately these huge video screens, but instead of kind of nationalistic imagery of the landscape or of the Chinese people, you see kind of these kind of almost ironic deployments of Chinese slogans in this work. I was wondering if you could talk about these two works specifically, and is it irony that we should be taking from this work? Like, what kind of tone do you intend for them to be read with?
Well, you know, I think one of the things I try very hard to do is not to really to open up different possibilities for the viewer to see my work, and that's actually the nature of a lot of my language piece, and also, you know, in the language itself, and also in the form itself. So talking about this piece, Please Ask Me Why. It's interesting that you read it as no thinking. I would say this is one way of reading. When I was showing this to my nephew, you know, the work, he say, "Oh, on thinking, you know, are you doing on thinking?" I say, "Oh, really? That's what you read?" He said, "Yeah, that reads on thinking." Because these are actually T5 lighting, which is everyday material. It's not neon. It's not other thing. It's just an everyday material, which I always use, try to use in my work. And they are hanged down from the ceiling like a lighting. But the way how they are positioned is a three-dimensional work. The way how they are positioned, you can read it as no thinking. You can also read it as unthinking. Mm-hmm. Depends on actually how your brain registers this image that are normally 2D, which is text. Mm-hmm. But then in this case, the text is hanging upside down, you know, on top of you, and you have a 3D kind of some kind of an illusion. Mm-hmm. And so I think talking about no thinking as a phrase itself is also a phrase that I came up with. I don't actually remember or recall how I actually the first time I came up with this sentence, but I find it very interesting because it's a very short phrase, almost like an idiom, mm-hmm. that I think talks about many different situations. Mm-hmm. You know, in the political sphere, it may be about China, but it can also be about many different mm-hmm. other things. It can be about the consumerism culture. It can be about philosophy or even Buddhism. Mm-hmm. So it's a very short phrase that can potentially speak about many different situations. And you know, the originally this slogan was, this very short phrase was used as signage that I made for another work of mine. Mm-hmm. But then for this exhibition, because there is the form as well in a gallery mm-hmm. setting, there's the space. So I designed it in such a way that not only there's, you know, not thinking or unthinking, but the way that how you move around in the space would also affect how this very short phrase can be interpreted. Mm-hmm. So I always try to open up different possibilities of, you know, looking at even one sentence or one form.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your piece, your Red Capital Land, you kind of take it to maybe a higher degree or a more intensive degree. You've kind of researched and culled from the media various kind of remarks, right, by mayors, leaders, and others. And then you've kind of repurposed them in a way, or redeployed them. Buying House is Patriotic, reads one. The price of housing has now increased for 30 years. To oppose the rise of real estate industry is anti-human. You know, there's this really inventive research going through the media kind of environment, culling these particular remarks, and then kind of redeploying them in this artwork. In this case, it's not just a universal kind of indictment of a culture that would be not thinking enough or could be thinking more. I mean, here it seems very specific to a particular political and ideological kind of context. Could you talk more about this work?
Yeah, let me give you the background for these slogans.
Sure.
They are actually, in 2009, the most popular internet sayings, you know, there's maybe about 20 sayings, and you know, is being elected as the 20th most popular saying, not in the internet, I mean in the, you know, in China, but this survey came out on the internet, and among these 20 20 or so saying, there are almost over 10 of them that are centered around real estate development. I mean, one of the and then, you know, the so these are the Chinese slogans, and as you go through them, you would be amazed at how interesting the, you know, the government is working very closely with the private sector, mm-hmm. which is the real estate developers, mm-hmm. to, you know, to actually boost the real estate development in China. And as you see my English text, which is you know, y.our.red.cap.it.aland. So, if you read it, it's called Your Red Capital Land. Mm-hmm. But the way the text is being broken up, you can also see our mm-hmm. Red Capital Land.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
While it can, the capital land is also break down into cap it all land.
Right.
And the characters red are in three different colors, which is yellow, blue, and green.
Hmm.
So the whole, so it's a very difficult to explain piece unless you see it yourself. But then again, it talks about, it draws inspiration, of course, from this government slogan and also the situation right now in China. But it actually, one of the thing, why I use the word capital land and red capital land, that goes back again to the history of communism in China, where there is this term called red capitalist. And red capitalist actually is a saying coined by Chairman Mao Zedong in the early 1950s. And it's actually referring to those capitalists that are also a communist member. And you would think, wow, what an interesting concept. You know, capitalists that are actually Communist Party members, and you know, this is the juxtaposition of ideologies. You know, that goes back actually in the Mao times, where they are trying to develop the economy. You know, trying to get the capitalists to work alongside with the government, which is a very very hardcore communist government at that time. And that goes back, you know, many years in the Chinese history. And because one of the thing, you know, the show talks about is actually this different, you know, this contradiction in putting together different ideologies. And actually, I think this is one of the reason why China nowadays is so disorientating and there are so many problems in China, is because there are two completely different ideologies, one that of capitalism and the other one that of communism. And they're not just ideologies, they become a kind of a system, a kind of a social system that is actually going hand in hand in China nowadays. So that's why this term of your red capital land, because the your can become our. And this is the main dichotomy between capitalism and communism.
Mm-hmm.
In capitalism, we always talk about your, which is an individual,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, which is one person, is an individual thing. And our is, you know, collective. And that's, you know, that's the main differences between and the I think the conflict between the two system, and putting them together become a red capital land, which is, you know, China is a capital land, and red capital land is that what China is turning into. And the reason why red is in different color, you know, I think is very very easy to know, like all these slogans, all this propaganda. They are trying to be something that they are not. They are telling you something that are not.
So if we were to then speak more broadly about your work, for you, language is both the site where all of these political tensions, this history, and this compromise is legible, but it's also the site where, as an artist, you can do an archaeology, so to speak, and uncover these kind of forgotten or overlooked historical kind of dimensions to language, but also you can kind of uncover the ideological ramifications of how language is being deployed today. Would you agree with that?
Yes. I'm thinking about that. I am so, you know, sensitive to language. I think there are different reasons. First of all, my grandfather is a writer, so I think, you know, there's part of the genetic thing. Mm-hmm. And then growing up and working so much in China, the propaganda is still so much in the, you know, in the most I would say the most native form, which is, you know, through language. You know, there's in the rural village, for example, where I work in a lot, there's no, you know, there's no internet at that time. There's hardly any TV. So a lot of these dissemination of knowledge of others of how things should be or should not be is through language. And I think, you know, as an NGO worker and trained as, you know, in sociology, I think I'm always much more attached or attracted to how people think of certain things and how people look at certain things. And that's why, you know, my practice is, I think, very much language based, because, you know, language very, very instantly is actually the carrier of thinking, you know, a carrier of how people think and talk about things. And I think what I'm trying to do is retake a lot of these everyday slogan, everyday, you know, they might be political, they might be, you know, from commercials, they might be a very short observation of mine that describe situations that is sometimes social, sometimes political, sometimes it's just my own observation. But then I try to give open up the possibility of reading this language in many different, you know, in many different that speaks about many different situations. We have a lot of idioms in China. I don't know, is it the same? But, you know, we always joke that we Chinese have a two or three words to conclude about all kinds of situations. And I think that is a little bit similar to the way how I draft up this language or these words for my piece. Is I try to draft very, very short, you know, phrases or terms or words, but they can potentially speak about many different situations.
Although so much of your work indeed has been specific to China and to kind of slogans and kind of ideologically laced remarks and positions that you would find in China, you also became quite known as an artist for this piece that you did at Beaux-Arts in Paris in 2010. So I was wondering if you could talk more about that, and I guess specifically, besides just describing what that piece consisted of, I mean, does this mean that you have a pattern? There's patterns in your work. Is there a methodology? I mean, it's almost as if you have a tactic or a strategy when it comes to, like, unpacking the implications of this ideologically laced language. Does that mean you have kind of a methodology, or do you approach each one in a radically different way or an open way, I guess?
I don't have a methodology. If I have one, I would be very relieved. I wish I could find one, but no, every time I approach these projects very, very intuitively and spontaneously. And but, you know, I think there is a belief in me that I would try to open up the possibility of reading these, you know, these terms, and also to provoke people to think about, you know, different possibilities about social or political situation, or even, you know, about human condition. So, but I always like to, and by doing that, sometimes it's just with the language that is used itself, sometimes it's with the form. I invent some form of system so that this language would in turn turn into many different meanings. For example, the piece in Paris, that's again a typical piece where people would say, oh, it's a political work. But for me, yes, it draw from a very well-known political, you know, slogan of Nicolas Sarkozy, which is a slogan that he used for his presidential campaign. And the first time I heard of this slogan, and the more I go to France, because my ex-husband is from France, so I, you know, it's not like I just know France for 2 years while I was studying there. I know this country for a long time before that. I live in Paris. So one of the big thing for me in France, and I'm sure a lot of people will agree, is about work. French people are always thinking about, you know, or complaining about how to work less, or, you know, strike and all these things. So, it, you know, it's well known. So when I look at this slogan on Nicolas Sarkozy, I find it so funny.
The slogan was work more to earn more.
Yes, travailler plus pour gagner plus. I thought, wow, this guy is such a genius to come up with such a slogan, because he really get his finger on the sore spot of the French people. And, you know, in a way, the French culture, allow me to say that. And it's also a very, very interesting slogan, because it is, the basic principle of the, you know, in a way, the ideology that people believe in the capitalist system. You earn more, you would get more. So everybody, you know, believe in this kind of work ethics. But not a lot of people actually look at, in this system, who works more and who earns more. Mm-hmm. You know, and the basic thing I think about capitalist system is, you know, you have labor, and the capitalist actually took the return that the labor should have got and become their capital. So in a way, the basic thing about the capitalist system is the workers work more, and, you know, the boss earn more. And basically, this is what the slogan is talking about. But it sounded so almost like a rule of nature, right. You know. Which is true too in some of the religious belief, you know, if you want something, you have to work for it. You work more, you will earn more. So it itself, this slogan already has so many implications, right. You know, politically, socially, philosophically, and, you know, in terms of the ideologies too.
So could you take me through what you did? So you kind of put in the individual words of the phrase on vertical banners. And then what were some of the different meanings that could be construed depending on how you approached the banners, in what order, from what side of the street?
Well, there are two banners, so there are four sides of the banners. So if you walk from one left to right, you would see work less. Mm-hmm. If you walk from the other side of the Seine River, you would see earn more. Mm-hmm. But if you come out from the main door of the Beaux-Arts, of the school, mm-hmm. where the two slogans are right beside you, left and right, you see more and less. Mm-hmm. So really depend on, you know, which way you're walking. You, for example, if you walk right out of the door, you would see less earning. Mm-hmm. And if you walk the other side, you would see less, more work. So, and then, you know, of course, it's up to the viewer to decide whether they want to look at both sides of the slogan and in which sequence they like to construct their sentence. It could be, you know, work less, earn more. It could be less work, more earning. Mm-hmm. It could be earning more, earning less. More work. So there's all kinds of different ways of interpreting it. But of course, a lot of people see that as I just change one word of his slogan, mm-hmm. and what I mean is to work less and earn. For work less and earn more, mm-hmm. which is again what is a very interesting slogan for the French situation, because the strike. You know, strike is like the biggest thing in France. Every month, every other 2 weeks, there are different sectors in France that is striking, which is what they're asking for, to work less and to earn more. You know, so again, it's a slogan with that, things that speak about the situation in France, but then it also speaks about other situations. About work and return.
So perhaps one more question on this note. I know that it's quite familiar already what happened, right? The school took down the work out of concern, if I understand correctly, that they would upset Sarkozy, And in a media kind of sensation had resulted, you had engaged the media, and a great deal of media coverage had ensued. And in a way, the piece had a second life, or an afterlife, or a continued life through the media. Is that correct in a way? Am I understanding it correct?
Yes, it's something that was completely unexpected. But thanks to the censorship, the impact of the work actually, you know, multiplied. I don't know how many times, of course, because of the huge media report, a lot more people get to know about this work. And actually, it started a lot of other discussion about censorship, for sure. Also about what is art, because a lot of people ask whether two banners can become art. Mm-hmm. And of course, the discussion about the freedom of speech under the Sarkozy rule. So it's really like totally unexpected. But I was very, very happy about it, because, you know, this is what actually I want to do with my work, to provoke people to think, and, you know, not just about one thing, but about many different things.
Right. I know that you've, so much of your work has happened in the public sphere, either deriving its inspiration from slogans and other remarks and language one would find in the public sphere, or it's literally been cited, it's played out in the public sphere. This would be an example. Mm-hmm. So you've also mentioned that Hans Hacke and those kinds of artists from the West have been an inspiration to you, or have kind of played a role maybe in your aesthetic education. Would you say then that the ensuing media coverage is part of the work? I guess I'm less interested in, like, would you put it in the catalog or the book form or not? But do you include the media kind of coverage that ensued from this act of censorship by the school? Do you see that also as part of the work?
I think I did the right thing to, you know, to insist on defending my right to exhibit these two pieces of banner. But whether that is part of an artistic practice, I guess I could, you know, because I don't really know where do you draw the line, where, you know, where do I stop become an artist and become someone else? I'm an artist, but, you know, I do what I think is right, and to defend, you know, my artwork can be presented at the form and at the space where they, you know, should be. I think, you know, it's important. So, for every artist.
Uh-huh. So would you, I mean, you know, Hacke at one point in this conversation with Pierre Bourdieu, he talks about how he's not an artist who intends to be sensationalizing. He's not interested in being sensationalist, but he is interested in a way, producing or eliciting a sensation. He is interested in kind of moving a conversation in a way forward. And so there's a part of me that thinks that in a way that also happened through that media interaction. And I want to, maybe I'm kind of misunderstanding your practice and your earlier practice in the non-governmental sector, but there's a part of me which kind of would think that the relationship that you had at that moment to the media, and the way that the media was kind of a vehicle to talk about your work and to further the reflection that it's about, there's a part of me which wants to think that that is like a very mature or a very interesting new aspect of your practice that I hadn't seen in some of the other works.
Well, but then, you know, it's not within my control. Uh-huh. The censorship was really an unexpected act. Uh-huh. But I stand firm, and I also reacted very quickly to, you know, to the situation. Uh-huh. But what I cannot control is I can't control the media, and I can't really control what people say about it. The media, you know, I contacted two or three medias to begin with, but then a lot of the other media just came to me afterwards, without, you know, without me asking them. And but, you know, it's not just the media. At that time, I also had a lawyer that, you know, very, very voluntarily helped me with the with the issue. So
I understand. Could you talk about Memory of Air in one of your catalogs? The caption, I suppose, the inscription that accompanies the title "Memory of Air," in which you are kind of positioned very quietly. You're standing in a, what looks like a kind of a Hong Kong street scene, with your finger pointed up, your eyes blindfolded, and the inscription in the catalog is right in the air, 6-4 with the right index finger until exhaustion. Is this 2006 performance, is it to be understood in relationship to June 4th?
Yes. Actually, every year since 2002, I've been making performances or artwork every year during June 4th. In fact, my show last year in Beijing, Don't Think Too Much, opened on the date of June 4th. So it's a very important event for me personally, and I think for a lot of people in the world, it's a very unforgettable event. But one of, I think, you know, if I just go back to talk about this piece, I think one of the things is about this notion of remembering and forgetting, and, you know, this notion of memory, because in Hong Kong, we have a very strong movement, you know, ever since June 4th in 1989 to support this movement. And afterwards, every year, there's a big congregation of people on the day of June 4th in Victoria Park to remember those who has been killed, and also to make a wish that one day democracy will come and freedom of speech will come to China. So, but then, you know, it's sort of a very conflictual and very weird situation, because such an important event in the world, I would say, and of course more so for China, is never talked about in China. Never. It's a taboo. It's like a blank. You know, it's like this memory has to go, or this memory can only exist in a very, very transparent form. Mm-hmm. And you know, in China, I many years of being here, I've met people that was, you know, that was my age. Some of them don't even know about what is June 4th. And there are people that tell me that June 4th is Western media Photoshop makeup, you know, and or there are people that know very, very vaguely, but absolutely almost nothing about June 4th. For me, that is very, very sad and very, very shocking. And the way how, you know, the government is able to erase or to withhold and to really make a very important part of history just somehow disappear is really, really appalling for me. Mm-hmm. And of course, in Hong Kong, you know, as the year go by, this year we're the 22nd year of June 4th, you can see, you know, people sort of move on from in the beginning in 1989, there are 1 million Hong Kong people that march on the street. And, you know, late, you know, every year the people that congregate for June 4th just sort of just, you know, gets fewer and fewer. But now, more or less, every year there would be 20 or 30,000 people on the day of June 4th that would go to the meeting, which is still, you know, the biggest in the world and is very, very significant. So I guess my action, you know, is a reaction, is a very bodily and metaphorical reaction to this situation that I was telling you about China, about Hong Kong. And, you know, the my performance practice is, or actually my language practice, you know, I think one part of it also, it really comes from poetry. Even though they might seem very, very, you know, some of the language piece may seem very, very, just very, very dry, you know, taken from political slogan. But, you know, I try to, in a way, you know, give possibility of reading these things also in a poetic way.
In the West, you know, we often refer to June 4th as Tiananmen Square, Tiananmen Square Massacre. Can mm-hmm. you talk a bit more about, like, the different ways as an artist or as someone residing in China, as a Chinese citizen, like, the different ways that you can and cannot talk about June 4th? I mean, this performance, unlike your other works, it's incredibly quiet. It's almost invisible. I think you once mentioned to me that it was actually something that you had come up with just as the actual performance, the the way that you conducted it, kind of holding your right index finger in the air until exhaustion, writing out June 4, that this was something you had come up with just before, I guess. There seems to be, like, could you talk more a bit about how difficult it is to talk about something like June 4th?
It's funny because another student, two or three actually students, wrote to me about this piece and asked me, "Oh, you know, how do you came up with this piece?" My answer to them is the same. The reason that I came up with this, you know, only the day doesn't mean that I was not working on it. It's almost like a poet searching for the right word, you know, in the poetry. You're preparing, you find, you know, I have many ideas, but none of them really, you know, was you know, you don't feel it's right. But until that morning, until I really arrived at that street with the people walking by, I really found the language, the physical language, or the visual language that I want to use for myself and that I want to project out. I think, you know, that gesture of writing with my index finger in the air, 6 and 4, is captures exactly how I feel, you know, about June 4th on you know, in that period. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if I answer your question.
Well, I mean, I guess I could ask it in another way. I know that another part, I don't know if you would think of it as part of your practice as an artist, although I want to, I guess. I know that you're actively involved online in microblogging, and you're actively involved, I don't know if you would identify as a netizen, but as someone who is also very much kind of seeing the internet as a means of talking freely and communicating with others about the political and other economic and social changes that are happening right now in the world and in China. I guess I'm interested in, like, do you, I guess to go back a step, do you see that as part of your practice? Because it seems to me that you're equally creative and inventive, as are most others, in trying to evade censorship and the internet censors in your use of language online, as you are in your kind of other practices as an artist in galleries and elsewhere. So I don't know if there's a clear question there, but I mean, like, how far can you extend kind of your understanding of your work? Do you think of, I mean, could you go back and explain exactly how this microblogging kind of environment functions and what that entails? But also, do you see that as part of your work, I guess?
As again, you know, it's like, where do I draw the line when I stop being an artist and be some, you know, I think it's all integrated. On the internet, you know, I post things. Sometimes I would post some images that I took. Sometimes I would post news, and you know, I would just see that as part of how I interact with the world. Uh-huh. But then, you know, whether that is my practice of being an artist, I don't really know. I would rather say that's, you know, what I do, what I think is right as a human being. Uh-huh. And sometimes, you know, I post my artwork on there. Sometimes I post other things. And, you know, I guess it doesn't really matter, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. whether to call that art or not art.
Okay. I mean, would you be comfortable talking more about kind of the microblogging and like how language works there? I mean, like, for instance, you couldn't write, I mean, to go back to Memory of Air in a way, I mean, you couldn't write online June 4th.
That is not my invention. If you talk about creativity to, you know, grew out of censorship, you would be amazed how, you know, how the netizen in China is so creative, you know. So they invented another term for June 4th, which is the 35th of May. Mm-hmm. So there is no 35th of May, but then, you know, this is how they talk about June 4th. And for a lot of other taboo terms, they have different ways of saying it. For example, the the name of Ai Weiwei right now is being censored, so they would come up with a term which is future, Wei Lai, which is the sounds like the last sounds like the surname of Ai Weiwei.
Mm-hmm.
And also at the time when there is the Jasmine Revolution,
mm-hmm.
When there are the call for Jasmine Revolution in China, they come up with other terms to talk about the Jasmine Revolution and to also to talk about the places where people should gather. And they have a special word for people to gather for the Jasmine Revolution, and they try to change it every week.
Mm-hmm.
And so that the censorship becomes more and more difficult because,
mm-hmm.
for example, the name of Ai Weiwei as future, how do you censor the word future from the internet is very, very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, at that time for the Jasmine Revolution, the word Jasmine is being censored on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they try to came up with some other terms that are very, very common. For example, I don't know if this is actually being employed as one of the term, but one of the suggestion is actually real estate.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes on to tell you the irony of the whole situation, you know,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, is a government that again, as I talk about in the piece, your Red Capitaland very much working together with the businessmen in the real and the real estate companies rather than with the people.
Would you be interested in talking about a bit of, like, I mean, you're multifaceted. You have all these dimensions to your practice, but, you know, my understanding is you also are engaged in kind of a certain, let's say, street art or graffiti kind of culture, and then you've
mm-hmm.
also designed T-shirts for both
yes.
performative events, but also, I think, for protests. Could you talk a bit about either of those practices or both of those?
Yeah. Well, I think I always find the street more interesting than, you know, the museums and the galleries. I like walking in the street. I like observing what is happening in the street. I get a lot of my inspiration, you know, from everyday life or from, you know, so to speak, the street. And I also like the spontaneity, you know, the 'cause chance and spontaneity is a very important element in my work. A lot of my work, you know, has a big element of where chance would determine how the meaning and the form of the work would take place. And the street situation, you know, is very interesting for me. And of course, I'm also, you know, coming from the NGO background, and as I tell you, is how I try to engage myself to make an impact to the world. So I would like to think that the street is a very good setting because you can present your work theoretically to, you know, a lot of people. And that's also one of the reasons why in Paris, when I was doing the show, I chose to exhibit my work on the facade of the school rather than inside in the gallery, because I want to, in a way, show my work to people that would not normally come into the gallery, that are not actually deliberately looking at art.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want to show my work to people that, you know, might not necessarily think that they're going to come and look at some art. And so in that sense, I'm really trying to distribute, you know, I'm trying to engage in some kind of campaign and some kind of a media campaign, if I, you know, but
mm-hmm.
except that I'm not using a formal kind of media. I'm using, you know, artistic languages or, you know, languages within the visual art sphere to distribute these thinkings or these artworks. So, yes, I've been doing several, you know, in the past, a lot of my performances happened on the street setting. And actually, when I was organizing performance festival, I also very deliberately tried to do organize performance events on the street and also in gallery and theater kind of setting, so that there is a balance where people cannot pay or people do not necessarily go to gallery would still be able to see the artwork. And I've also done projects in Sao Paulo where there is, I wouldn't call that graffiti, it's really like large-scale outdoor building installation.
Mm-hmm.
And I've also done things on the street, actions and performances that does not engage myself but engage other people. Again, this is all within the belief of my artwork, that I think art should be everybody has a right to look at art, and not just people that has actually the privilege or have the money to go into galleries or theaters. Other people should also have the chance to look at art. Mm-hmm. And also street is a much more dynamic and without control kind of setting. You don't know what is going to happen to your piece. And so I like this kind of, in a way, uncertainty and risk that you encounter on the street. I think that opens up the possibilities of the work as well. And talking about and the T-shirt, one of the things I like to do is I use a lot of everyday life material in my work. I've worked with T-shirt, I've worked with banners, I've worked with Rubik cubes, I've worked with T5 light. I guess that's again another belief for me as an artist that I want to make art sometimes out of material that does not look so much like art. Mm-hmm. I've worked with signages that that really like copy the aesthetic and the everything of real life signages. I think that brings brings to the very interesting question of where do you draw the line between art and everyday life. And I like to make that confusion. I like to let people have this kind of a confusion when they think they're just, encountering something in the everyday life situation, looking at something that is from everyday life. Suddenly something hit them and they realize that, oh no, something is wrong. This is more than just a normal banner or a normal Rubik cube or normal signage or normal T-shirt. There is something else in there. And that something else will maybe provoke them to think of, their very comfortable or very taken for granted everyday life environment differently next time when they encounter this kind of object. And the T-shirt that I've made before was basically, T-shirt with text with Chinese text on them. And I have also done one with the English text. But the basic principle is that these words, maybe I'll use the English one as an example to better explain what is the concept. So on my English version, I've done an English T-shirt. So there are words, say, individual words. For example, think, say, feel, see, believe, and do. So you have these individual words printed individually on the T-shirt. And at the back of the T-shirt, there is free. And then there are two more words in front, which is something and nothing. Mm-hmm. So as people wear all this T-shirt, different combination will appear. So there will be, think nothing, see something, or see something, do nothing, or see something, do something, or say something, do nothing. There's many different again combination of these situation where that is related to say, see, feel, do, believe, and say, see, feel, do, believe. There is one more, I can't recall now. But anyway, the principle is the same. So, again, it's just a very simple T-shirt. It's not, it's nothing fancy. But then when you get it into like a group kind of setting, it would create all kinds of different meanings. But then this T-shirt individually also, speaks a lot, about that person, and would give the person a totally different presence. Mm-hmm.
Does this practice emerge from the very complicated ideological setting that you find yourself living in China, or does it emerge as also from this globalized upbringing that you had? You were born in China, you were raised in Hong Kong, you've You've been kind of immersed in and across different languages throughout your life. So does this, I mean, is this project, is your work as an artist kind of both kind of a product of that kind of upbringing in a kind of a household marked by so many different languages, or should it be more understood in relation to kind of the political circumstances that you find yourself in modern China? Or is it both?
I think it's you know, it's a combination of all these factors that give birth to me such a strange creature. I think one part of it is the dictatorship of language. Mm-hmm. You know, that I experience, especially within the propaganda machine of the Chinese government. You know they use language in such a violent and how do you say, conservative way, mm-hmm. that sometimes you really feel is a tyrant of mm-hmm. language. Mm-hmm. You know, but of course they are very, very good in it. They mm-hmm. are extremely good in it. You know, these slogans of one world, one dream. You know, every 2 or 3 years they come up with some slogans that are really very clever and very incredible. But, you know, the ideology behind sometimes is very, very suffocating, you know. And I guess one part of me is always trying to revolt against this, you know, the one only cube that I made that make use of the six different, you know, six different set of words, that some of them came from the slogan, which is one world, one dream, which is for the Olympic. Mm-hmm. And then there's one family, one child, which is the talk about the one child policy in China, one husband, one wife, one nation, one race, one country, one system, and one party, one voice. These are all, you know, some of them are actually government policy. Some of them are actually slogan, and some of them are redefinition, or I change one or two terms of, mm-hmm. you know, the government slogan. But just hearing that, you can feel how, you know, how they are very good at, you know, pushing forward some ideologies in a very forceful way through languages. And the fact that I use a cube, which is a very, you know, playful and almost like a mundane daily life object, to carry this very, very big and grand, you know, slogan and ideology, is also trying to, you know, to make fun of the situation. And then the fact that the cube can be turned around and these slogans will be completely redefined into sometimes something that is very funny, sometimes that is something very poetic, sometimes it does not make any sense at all. And I guess this is part of, you know, part of the strategy. Whether that you know, that part, again, you know, is a rebellion, revolt against this tyranny of language. And with regard to, you know, growing up in Hong Kong, I guess, you know, this idea of, you know, making this T-shirt where, you know, when as you move around, the meanings will change. I guess this is actually very similar to how Chinese text, Chinese words operate. You know, that is a very different, that the very specific thing about the Chinese languages is if you put one word with another word, sometimes they can mean totally different meaning. If you put one word in front of another word, they can mean totally something else. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you understand what I'm mm-hmm. saying. So I guess maybe one part of me is always trying to think, oh, you know, if I do this and this, this and that to the Chinese words, when they put them together, it will mean something totally different as a concept. Right. You know, as a concept, not as a sentence. And maybe that's the inspiration. That's actually maybe why I'm so obsessed with trying to redefine how text is being read. You know, maybe that's the system that I learned as I learned Chinese, you know, because there are so many different possibilities of putting words in different orders and sequences and recurrences that can mean so many different things.
Mm-hmm. Maybe one last question on my end, on my part. would have to do with, I mean, I've asked you about your practice in relationship to a number of Western artists, Hans Hacke and others. But you're also quite close with a number of artists that are associated with and really founded, established the STARS movement, the STARS kind of generation of artists as the Cultural Revolution mm-hmm. was ending. Can you talk about your relationship to some of those artists? And also in light of the fact that that one of those has been disappeared in the last days as part of a larger crackdown, as part of the Jasmine Revolution. So can you both mm-hmm. talk about your relationship to that generation, but also perhaps, I don't know, that relationship in wake of the recent weeks?
Yeah, I actually forgot to talk. Well, I didn't really follow up your question about Hans Hack. I mean, yeah, I mean, I have it's kind of a strange hybrid, you know, that the artists that really influenced me. There is some artists like Hans Hack, Bruce Nauman, which is a very, very important influence, and Yoko Ono, Akonji, you know, a lot of these artists had a very, I would say they're Western artists, but, you know, I don't know if that's a very precise term. And, of course, Marcel Duchamp. And as in China, artists like Huang Rui, and, he's a close friend, and also, you know, the way how he works with language, there is, of course, similarities.
You mean his large scale paintings of, like, for instance, the word China,
like He has done also a number of other text pieces that mm-hmm. you know plays with concept and the mm-hmm. way how Chinese language could play with Chinese language, mm-hmm. and but another two artists that Chinese artists that are actually of very, very strong influence to me, although it might not be so evident, is actually Huang Yongping. Mm-hmm. And Chen Zhen, mm-hmm. and but you know Huang Yongping does not usually work with language, but you know he's actually from the same hometown as me, and I always like the metaphor of his work, although he does not directly use his language very often. And Chen Zhen, you know, is just like the alchemist of everything. He used so many elements in his work, and they all blend in and become transformed into something else so nicely. And, you know, language, imagery, materials, and ideologies, you know, for me, he's like a very, very strong influence on me. And for example, Ai Weiwei, I mean, some of his work I like very much. Some of his work I don't like so much. But for sure, you know, he's one of the artists that I think has done some very important artwork. And his engagement as a social activist, you know, is very remarkable. The fact, you know, he's the only artist in China that has such a strong following. You know, on the internet, he has over 70,000 followers on Twitter. And, you know, the Chinese government closed down his microblog. But before that, he also have a big, big following. And this is something that, you know, is huge for me, no matter what he has done, no matter what the charges are going to lay against him, you know, in the coming days. I still think that he has done something very remarkable as a social leader and activist in China, because, you know, he very actively speak out on a lot of different social incident in China that, you know, that especially in the artistic circle, nobody has actually speak out. And he, not only does he speak out, he also take very concrete action to advocate for these incidents to be exposed to the government, to do something to solve these problems. And I think, you know, that's one of the reasons why he got arrested right now. And for that, I have a lot of admiration for what he has done for this social incident as a social activist.
Could you talk about questions of translation? Clearly, your work kind of exists across languages, in language. Can anything be translated? And does your upbringing maybe in a way kind of give you some insight into that?
Well, growing up in Hong Kong, I guess we all have this, you know, this dilemma that we have two languages to work with. One is Chinese, which is Chinese being Cantonese and Mandarin, two different dialects. But, you know, the text is, the written form is always Chinese language, it's traditional Chinese language. And whereas in China, they have the simplified Chinese language. And, of course, English is the official language even until now, it's the official language in Hong Kong. So I guess as I grew up in this environment, I'm always trying to, you know, translation always in progress in me. When I learn things in Chinese, I'm thinking of how to express them in English. And then when I'm learning things in English, I'm always trying to think how to, you know, make sense of them in Chinese. And it could be, you know, is actually one of the good thing, and also sometimes it also gave, you know, is your inability. It's like everything else in life, you know, you have something that is good, but you have something that is bad. So we have this great language environment, but at the same time, sometimes translation is just impossible, and sometimes it becomes frustrating. And I think translation itself sometimes is not just about the meaning of the words. The meaning of the words is always linked to the context, which is also linked to the culture. And sometimes these kind of loss in translation or failure in translation actually stem from the differences in the two, you know, culture. And I guess some of my, you know, as you can see in some of my work is, and that's also one of the frustration being a language-based artist. Some people, you know, a very well-known Chinese artist, one look at my work and say, "Solan, why do you want to work with language? When you work with language, you naturally, you know, exclude some other people that does not know your language from you know, understanding your work." I say, "Yeah, I know, but then that's really something that I'm concerned about. So you know what? I have no choice." And some of my work, they can only exist in the form of Chinese, or English. For example, the one only cube, it does not make sense to translate them in this form, in the cube form, into Chinese. I can try to translate the multiple meanings, but then as a form of, as an object itself, it does not work if I translate them into Chinese, because some of the English word has double meanings, and those double meanings will in turn create other meanings when they team up with other words. Mm-hmm. And it's the same case with some of my Chinese work. For example, the text piece that I've done as a t-shirt, the recent one for Ai Weiwei and the one, you know, that I've done before with the Chinese character, they cannot be translated into English, mm-hmm. because again, these Chinese words has now multiple meanings, and those multiple meanings create yet other meanings when they are combined. Mm-hmm. And another piece.
But you also seem to actually take it one step further. You often deliberately don't translate some of the phrases in your work, like in the Harmonious Sign series, for instance. Right, where there's signs that both have Chinese characters as well as English on them.
I guess I'm trying to like make fun. Well, if I can't really translate, why do I just try to make fun of this inability and sometimes misunderstanding in translation? Uh-huh. Because again, in China, that happened a lot in China when I see signs that are completely mistranslated. For example, one of my signs in English is having fun prohibited. Mm-hmm. In Chinese, it actually means, don't play, you know, because it's a signage to be used in some kind of formal setting. Mm-hmm. But then they translate it in such a way, it, in English, becomes having fun prohibited. And when I look at it, I find this is so, you know, so funny. But it's more than just funny. It's also about ideology and about, you know, the different view of authority in the two different culture. Mm-hmm. You know, so for a Chinese person or Chinese authority, when they want to translate that into Chinese into English, they would, you know, translate into, okay, then having fun is prohibited. Right, you know, right. And it's really bigger. So actually, I did a copy of that sign. Another of my signage sets corruption in progress, mm-hmm. which is a silent sign in Chinese, with, you know, with the silence gesture of a finger in front of your mouth, mm-hmm. and in Chinese actually it says silent, please keep silent.
Mm-hmm.
So if again, I try to play with this mistranslation that you find very common in China. So for a Chinese person, they look at this sign, well, it's a normal sign, keep mm-hmm. silent. For English-speaking person, they would see it as, wow, corruption in progress, and a silent sign, keep silent. But then for someone who understands both, you know, they would know that is playing on something about mistranslation, but also about the bigger situation of corruption. You know, some part of my practice, for example, you asked me about your Red Capital Land. There is a juxtapose of the Chinese and the English text.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, you know, they the two different people, two different culture that does not speak each other's language, when they look at the work, they would have maybe totally different understanding of the work is all about.